Hi everybody, how's it going? Hi, we're here in, I believe Deepika just gave you an introduction, Temple of Humanity? On a tour. Did you introduce all of the gods we have here? We have some old favorites like Ganesh, and also some more obscure local entities, from Maharashtra. All right, so how are we going with sound? Is sound good? Sound is good.
You are dark.
I am dark. People have said that often, yeah.
Very dark.
We can't put that in front, can we? Can we put that over there, that lamp? Is that possible? I can actually run off battery. My battery's full, if you need the extension.
Yeah,
but if you put that there, it'll be fine. Yeah.
It's because you have the light behind you.
The light is behind, yeah.
There we go. Whoop. Yeah.
That's better. Just have to find a place for it. That is better, isn't it?
Yes.
Figuring that out. All right, good. So does anybody need the chanting sheet? Michelle, do you need? No? No need to be offended. I was just making a polite inquiry. Fine. Okay, all experts here. All right, very good. So hi, everyone. Many people saying good morning from Sweden, from South Florida. Wow. Guten Morgen from South Florida. It cannot be a saying that we're just shifting. It'll be back in a minute, Dory. This cannot be a sane time of day in South Florida. No? Is any time of day really sane in South Florida, though?
Alyssa, no, it's always summer.
It's always summer, right? Alyssa here as well. Ah, excellent.
Yep. Oh, she's my buddy.
Okay, well, this is some also Venerable Dhammakipa. Are you from South? Have you always been from South Carolina, or are you? I thought you were in Sri Lanka. No.
Sorry, I have to open my mic about that. Good morning, Bante. Good morning, everybody. Terawan Saranai. No, I just came to South Carolina to the Carolina Buddhist Vihara 10 days ago. So I'm just here getting the place ready.
Really?
For Bhikkhuni Supeshala, who should arrive hopefully in January. And then.
Okay, how great.
Yeah, it's a lot of work because it's been closed for a few months. And so trying to get some people back in here.
Okay. Is that Venerable Sudama's place?
No, she moved to North Carolina a few years ago. Aya Sudinna was here, but she is almost 90 years old, so she returned to Sri Lanka and the place was empty.
Okay, I saw dinner.
And for a bunch of cockroaches, apart from some cockroaches, it was pretty empty when I got here.
Sounds like my place, anyway.
Meantime, but I don't think I'll stay in the United States.
That's good. I just want to say that I'm very happy that there are so many Bhikkhunis in the world that I don't know all of them anymore. So that's really nice. Okay, so Jenny, so let us begin. We're here on the land of the Bharamadigal people of the Darug Nation, just next to the Parramatta River, which was, of course, one of the sources of their livelihood. On the foreshore here, they have some memorials for the Aboriginal people, and one of them, they have these like canoes. So apparently when the white people first arrived in Sydney, one of the striking sights that they saw was that the people would have these canoes and then they would light little fires on the canoes and they would be out there at the nighttime on the river enjoying. I mean, it sounds nice, doesn't it?
Sounds a lot.
Yeah. So anyway, all right. So let us do some chant our devotions for the Triple Gem. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang saranang gacchami. Dhammang saranang gacchami. Sanghang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Iti piso bhagava arahang samma sambuddho. Vija charana sampanno sagato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma saharathi satta deva manusana buddho bhagavati svakato bhagavata dhammo sandhirtiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko pacatam vedita bovinyuhiti. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Ujjupatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Nyahaya patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Samichi patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Yadidam chattari purisa yugani attha purisa pungala. Esa bhagavato savaka sangho. Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakhirneyo anjali karaneyo anuttaram punyaketam lokasati. All right, very good. Okay. So now has come the time to do our Friday night meditation. There's some music background in there. If there's something there, we will definitely hear it as soon as we start meditating. So, yeah, we don't need to worry about that. All right, so, you know, I've been teaching in Sydney for a while now, 20 years or something, and I've been doing most of the time doing these Friday night sessions and teaching meditation, doing guided meditation. I don't know how many I've done, probably certainly hundreds, maybe thousands of meditation introductions and so on. And each time that I give a talk, I always make a point to begin with meditation because obviously it's such an important dimension of the Buddha's path, and also just for practical purposes, so that we can all settle down and prepare our minds for listening to the Dhamma. And so each week I come along and I say something about meditation. Being who I am, I try to say something different every week. I don't know if I succeed exactly, but I do try to bring different perspectives to meditation each week. And this may be a failing of mine. I think it's just come from my insecurity. One of my teachers, Ajahn Dunn in Thailand, he used to give like literally exactly the same teaching every time. Whenever any of the lay people would come to the monastery, he would always just say the same thing. He'd say, be generous, keep your precepts, and when you have time, you sit down and watch your breath coming in and out, be mindful of the breathing, and then just know that it's all impermanent. And that's, he would just like say exactly that every time. And look, I can't fault it, okay? It's a perfect teaching, but I always kind of feel like I want to try to say something different each time. Anyway, so I think most of the people here have probably done at least a little bit of meditation. We have some familiarity with it. And when the Buddha was introducing mindfulness of breathing meditation, he always would introduce it with the same phrase. So, sato va asasati, sato passasati. And the first phrase there, sato, being mindful. Mindful, one breathes in. Mindful, one breathes out. And this is the foundation of Buddhist meditation. When we say that we're being mindful, then we are bringing presence to our awareness. And we are sustaining that presence. There's like a, mindfulness has a sense of continuity to it. It has a sense that you keep on remembering what it is that you're doing. You're not like being forgetful and losing your place. And for those of us who've done meditation before, we would know that this is routinely not what actually happens. No matter how many times the Buddha says, be mindful when you meditate, you're like, great, I'll be mindful. And then like, if you make it a minute without forgetting and your mind wandering off, you think you're pretty good, right? If you make it through like two or three breaths without your mind wandering, then you can feel that's pretty good. Heck, even just one breath and you can already be gone. That's how quickly mindfulness can be gone. And of course, that's not an indication that there's something wrong with you. It's not an indication that you're, you know, not doing the meditation correctly or anything like that. It's simply a reminder of how flighty the mind is and why it's so important for us to actually do the meditation. So Venerable Dhammakipa says, as if Ajahn Dunn gave the same instructions, Albert Einstein was known for wearing the same type of grey suit every day to avoid washing time and mental energy on clothing choices. You know, a few years ago in Australia, there was a like a news presenter, and he wore the same suit every day on television for a year. And partly to highlight the standards, like if his female counterpart had worn the same blouse twice in a row, people would have been complaining, and he literally wore the same suit for a year and nobody noticed. So, yeah. Anyway. Moving on. So, to maintain mindfulness is to continue being present. And this dimension of mindfulness and memory is quite special to the Buddha. It was a new way of thinking about things that the Buddha introduced. Like the idea of mindfulness was around before the Buddha. In the Vedic tradition, mindfulness, or the word smriti, is used for remembering your sacred scriptures. And I know that there have been some arguments that the Buddha's sense of mindfulness, as in present awareness, is found before before the Buddha. But as in my opinion, those arguments are spurious because the passages that are being cited don't really establish that. And in fact, are just talking about remembering scriptures. The Jains also used the word mindfulness, and they tended to use mindfulness in the sense that we would think of as like being mindful, like they would say, like being mindful, like walking, that you wouldn't crush any living creatures. Like you wouldn't squash any ants when you're walking along. So you'd be very mindful and careful. So that kind of sense of mindfulness. So this is kind of, it was, the idea was kind of around like that, but the specific aspect of like developing mindfulness for meditation is first attested in Buddhist text. Anyway, I shouldn't get into the history of it because that's what I'm do too much of anyway. But the basic idea here is that the mindfulness was the presence with which we bring to meditation. Now we can get lost, and we often do. Like much of the world is designed to make us get lost. You walk into a shopping mall and all the surfaces are shiny and there's reflections everywhere and there's glass everywhere, and these environments are designed in order to take our mindfulness away. They want to bedazzle us and to distract us and to make us lose our mind so that you forget what it is that you came there to do, and you wander around saying, what, oh that looks nice, and then you spend money on things that you don't need. The whole purpose is to remove your mindfulness. The same with like advertising and the internet and apps and all of these things are designed to distract, to think about the shrinking, ridiculously shrinking attention span that's required from like social media and all of these different things. So you don't even taste something or experience something before the next thing comes along. And you know, you don't like get to experience like art or to pause and reflect on something someone says or to have the space, because everything is just the next thing. So mindfulness is about saying, what is this thing? Yeah. If you live your life for the next thing, you never have this thing. You never have anything, actually, because every time you have one thing, your mind is always on the next thing. So the purpose of meditation is, what is this thing? And the reality is that all of those next things that you might have are really just variations on a theme, a sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. It's just, you know, a bit different than what you've had before. And if you can't enjoy what is here, how can you enjoy what is there? Whenever you get there, you'll always be thinking what somebody else is doing or what we could be doing or what's next. And so to learn to meditate is to learn to be present. It's to learn to be content. It's to learn to that this is what matters. Actually, what this consists of is not so important. It could be anything. But the present in that is also what makes things very important. What is? So it's easy enough to say this, and I think that intuitively we can appreciate that this is the case. But the hallmark of the Buddha's teachings was to give us a way of training, a way of practicing that could actually teach us to find contentment in the present. That's the crucial thing. We do this, and there's no one trick for this. It's the whole spectrum of what we do in meditation that is supposed to support us to be in the present. One fallacy that we can bring into meditation is we bring in the same worldly ideas that we bring to everything else. That is to say, we come to meditation with that idea, oh, how can I get to the next stage? How can I do this? How can I complete that? And we have that same kind of worldly thinking in our meditation, which is natural. That's how we've been conditioned. And I do think that there's a difference here between like modern urban people and traditional people or people living in a rural background. If you're living in a rural background, you get used to the idea that things take their time. You can plant the crops. You know, when you plant the rice, it's hard work, and you get out there every day and you do that hard work. And then once it's planted, you just wait for it to grow, and there's not too much that you can do. And so there's this, everything has its season. And that idea that you work with those seasons and there's a time for work and a time for rest is not, we've kind of got rid of that. We can work all the time now. Heck, even on our holidays, we can still work. Yeah, yes, I guess that's progress, right? So we have this kind of idea that we're going to achieve something and create something rather than the idea that we're going to live. What if it were the case that this world was good enough? Like, the world is pretty amazing. I mean, I'm talking about like the planet that we live on, the planet Earth is kind of amazing, right? The cool streams and the beautiful blue skies and the bunny rabbits and all of the amazing things that are on this planet. I mean, certainly compared to other places in the universe, generally speaking, it's pretty good. And even for all of the mess that we've made of it, it's still pretty good. And so why do we keep on feeling like we keep having to do more and we keep having to have more and we keep having to get more? Yeah. So meditation should be a respite from all of that. It should be that feeling that this is enough, that I'm enough, that I don't need to be anywhere. I don't need to get anywhere. I don't need to change anything. I don't need to, actually, what I am now and who I am now is just perfectly fine. And when we can feel content like that, there's a sense of surrender into the meditation. And that sense of surrender, you can feel it. I mean, you can call it what you like. You can call it letting go. You can call it relinquishment. Call it contentment. But when that surrendering happens, you can feel that process of the meditation has its own presence. So I keep trying to draw attention to that. I say that, like, let the breath take care of you. There's an intrinsic quality to the breath and to the process of meditation that's inherently soothing. And it's just somehow is calming you down already. Even as we're sitting here right now, is already calming you down. And so rather than thinking of meditation as, oh, I've got to achieve this stage and that stage and the next, think of meditation as being tuning into that soothing rhythm that is already calming us down. Okay, let's do some meditation. So sitting quietly. Allowing the mind to settle down into the body. And just feeling the ordinary stillness of your body as it sits there. Letting all the worries of the past fade away. And not picking up all those anxieties about the future. What is real is the present. And in that present, the breath is soothing you, calming you, taking away all your troubles, bringing you to peace. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Now coming near to the end of the meditation. And just bringing mind back into the senses, listening to the sounds around. And taking a minute to reflect back over the meditation, inquiring into cause and effect. Ask yourself, what just happened? How did the mind change? What did you see? What did you hear? Like what things were plaguing your memory? What things were you worried about or afraid of? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. Okay, everybody. Thanks for joining me with that. And let's take a break for a couple of minutes and we'll come back for some Dhamma talk. The summertime and when it gets windy, yeah. So Skydale, you're just asking what's going on, so we're just having a bit of a break. We usually have a break after the meditation and for a couple of minutes you can grab a cup of tea, but I think we're back again now. We should be back more or less. Good, you got your cup of tea, excellent. So I just let you know, like, one of the reasons why we do it this way is because let me tell you a story. So when I went to Perth. We were just talking just now, one of our friends, Deepika, just been to Perth and the Buddhist Society there. And one of the stories that Ajahn Brahm told me about the Buddhist Society, he said when they first came, they would have evening meditations and talks and people would come along and they finish up and then they would go home. And that was that. And they realized that nobody was talking to each other and nobody was making any friends and making any connections. So they started offering a cup of tea after the Dhamma talk. And so then they found people would talk to each other and start to make relationships, start to make connections. And then from there, the whole Buddhist society sprung. So that's what we've done since we started here, is we put the break in the middle, because if you do it at the end, then often people will just go off anyway. So you've got to keep them trapped. And give them a chance to at least have a few minutes to chat. I mean, if you just want to sit and be quiet, that's all right. But it's nice to just sometimes meet some of the Dhamma friends and just exchange a few words. And then over time, you'll find that, you know, that suddenly these people are your friends and you care about them. So it's kind of nice. Okay. So last week, we're in the middle of our series on dependent origination, and we have so far covered the basics of dependent origination. We looked at the dependent origination in relation to creation myths. We looked at the etymology and background of the terminology. We looked at the grammar and the syntax of it, and we've spent a few weeks looking at some of the shorter suttas that disclose some of the interesting details and perspectives on dependent origination. Last week, we looked at the Kacchayanagata Sutta, which is perhaps one of the most interesting suttas. It talks about existence and non-existence. And we've seen kind of the pattern of how different terms and ideologies, which were around at the time of the Buddha, were taken up and responded to in a creative and analytical and very interesting way by the Buddha through this great teaching. Last week, in a moment of foolishness and weakness, I mused out loud, perhaps I might do something with Nagarjuna next week. And a few people said, yes, why don't you? So that's what I'm going to do. So look, first of all, let me just say, Nagarjuna is very difficult, and I am no expert, okay? So as far when we're dealing with the suttas, okay, fair enough, I know a few things about that, but Nagarjuna a glancing familiarity, all right? So don't get your hopes up too high, all right? What I would like to do is do something that would be like almost like an approach to Nagarjuna, like for people who are like most of the people here, our primary interest is in the early Buddhism and the practical application of the early Buddhism. And, you know, sometimes it's kind of tempting to just sort of skip over the last 2,500 years, pretend it didn't exist, and then just goes, that's all you have to do. But that's not actually how things work, because we interpret and come to the Dhamma through the lens of tradition. We can't really escape that, nor should we try to, because the continuity of human tradition actually is really beautiful and very profound. So within the vast spectrum of teachers, practitioners, philosophers, commentators, whatever, about Buddhism, Nagarjuna is one of the great lights and often regarded as the greatest Buddhist philosopher, perhaps the greatest Indian philosopher, and certainly one of the greats. Now, what I'll do to begin with, I will give a little bit of historical perspective to talk about who Nagarjuna was and what he was getting at. So bear with me. We're gonna just do a brief historical run. We're gonna be coming to, like I said, approach. We're gonna be approaching Nagarjuna from earlier times. We've already seen that this approach is very fruitful when trying to understand the suttas. We want to look at what was before the suttas, because then that gives us a perspective of what the Buddha was responding to. Similarly, considering Nagarjuna, we want to consider what he was responding to. Now, we've seen that the Buddha clearly in many cases is responding to the Vedic or other practitioners and philosophers who existed in India at the time, very reasonably. And then sometimes this quite literally so, like last week we saw the Lokayata Brahman, the cosmologist, come to the Buddha and ask a question and the Buddha literally responding to him. So when I say responding, sometimes it's as literal as that. And when we understand that dynamic, it gives us a more appreciation for the richness and the nuance of what the Buddha was talking about. Now, one of those ideas the Buddha was responding to was the idea of existence, which we already traced back to as far as the Nasadiya Sutta, maybe half a millennium before the Buddha. And then in the time of the Buddha rejecting the extremes of all exists and all does not exist and asserting instead the middle way of dependent origination. That is to say that things unfold through a process, a living or organic process of conditions rather than being something that exists eternally. Now, time went on. After the time of the Buddha and after the Buddha died, then there was a movement to formalize and systematize the Buddha's teachings. And that movement we call the Abhidhamma. Abhidhamma literally means about the Dhamma or concerning the Dhamma. And so what they would do was try to assemble the different teachings from different places and then say, oh, these terminologies map onto these ones, these ideas map onto these ones are different from that. And so they tried to sort of create a system that would give you a framework for seeing the teachings as a whole. And this is quite an innovative project. Like there's not that much precedent for it. And it's not an easy thing to do. Now, this Abhidhamma project was pursued in different ways among the different schools of Buddhism from about, let's say, 200 to 400 years after the Buddha. We saw the emergence of various schools of Buddhism, and the most prominent among whom were the Sarvastivadins, who taught all exists, sabbang ati, which is literally the thing that the Buddha rejected in the Katayanagata Sutta, which we're going to come to in a minute, okay? Sarvang asti, all exist. Then there was the Pogalavadins, who said that there's not a self as such, but there's a person or an individual. I actually discussed about this on Wednesday night a little bit. So Pogalavadins, and then there was the Mahasanghikas. Mahasanghikas believed that the Buddha was so ultimately supreme that he was more supreme than anything the supreme could be, and they wanted to exalt the Buddha and then downplay the Arahant a bit. The Arahant's not all that, like they're okay, they're fine, but and then by creating that gap, then in between left space for the Bodhisattva to appear, which of course was the advent of the Mahayana, which was after all of this. Anyway, so those three main schools, Sarvastivada, Pugalavada, and Mahasangika, and then left over from that is what we call the Vibhajavadins. Vibhajavadins is a group of schools. The most famous one we know is the Theravada of Anuradhapura, though in those days known as Mahaviharavasins. And there was a bunch of schools who all had very similar doctrines, but this group is really defined by the fact that they rejected these three theses. So they rejected the Sarvastivadin thesis that all exists. They rejected the Pugalavada thesis that there is an individual that is neither identical with or different from the aggregates. And they rejected the Mahasangika view about the complete transcendence of the Buddha. For the Vibhajavadins, the Buddha was still a human being. So these, okay, so that's a brief summary of the history of Buddhism for like 200 to 400 years after the Buddha. Now, all of those schools had a version of what we call the Abhidhamma, and those Abhidhammas were all different. And they all summarized things in slightly different ways, although there was much in common between them as well. So that, again, it's a complex situation, which I don't need to sort of go into too much. Reacting to that Abhidhamma movement was a new movement that we call Mahayana. And the Mahayana movement adopted some of the innovations of the schools, for example, the transcendent nature of the Buddha and the importance of the role of the Bodhisattva. So it adopted these innovations, but then it rejected other premises of the Abhidhamma schools. In particular, you can see that early Mahayana sutras, they have these passages that say things like, oh, you see all of those monks sitting in their big monasteries, all enumerating all of the dhammas and all calculating them and all listing them and categorizing them and defining them, and none of them knows what any of those dhammas feels like. Right? And there's this kind of feeling that they're wanting to get back to the practice of the actual realizing of the heart of the teaching of Buddhism. And this is, I'm talking here about the early Mahayana sutras. And this philosophically, this became expressed in a series of discourses known as the Prajnaparamita discourses. The most famous one being the Heart Sutra. Is there's literally the Heart Prajnaparamita Sutra, which is a summary of Prajnaparamita doctrine, but other discourses are very long, dealing with the same kind of idea. And we're now up to maybe 500 years after the Buddha, give or take. All of these dates are very speculative. Maybe 500 years after the Buddha. And at that time, Mahayana didn't exist as an independent school of Buddhism, really. And in fact, for a long time in India, that was the case, if not for the whole period. So Mahayana was like a strain of thought or a way of practice that existed in the same monasteries as and the same communities as the conventional or early forms of Buddhism as well. It was first in China, in fact, that Mahayana was established as like independent, sort of separate, distinct schools of Buddhism. So there was a distinct philosophical movement, but it wasn't necessarily like it was in the same monasteries. Okay, so we've come now maybe 500 years after the Buddha. So we're talking about like maybe 100 AD, 1 to 200 AD, something very, very roughly around that time. Okay, now, one of the cardinal doctrines of the Abhidhammists was the doctrine of Swabhava. And this was very central. So what the Abhidhammas did was they defined and enumerated all of the dhammas in the world, all of the real phenomena, right? All of the things that exist. So they said that self doesn't exist. What we take to be a self, not real. What's real? Dhammas are real. What are those dhammas? Sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. That's some of them. Five aggregates. Dependent origination. Whole bunch of dhammas there. So all of those things which are the Buddha's teachings, feelings, pleasant, painful, neutral feelings, these things are all dhammas. These things are all like form, the four elements and so on. And it was something like an idea of elements, like the elements that make up existence or something like that. again, this is a very rough summary of a very complex movement, but it was something like that. At a certain point, people started to ask the question, well, what do we mean when we say something's a Dhamma? And they came up with a definition, which was Attanopanasabhavangareti Dhamma. So Dhamma is called a Dhamma because it bears its own intrinsic essence. Okay? It bears its own intrinsic essence. And this is really the key phrase, which is where the problems start. Maybe the problem started long before, but this is where the problems start. So what actually does this phrase mean, right? It kind of seems to mean, or it seems to imply, that the dhammas are things that truly exist in and of themselves, right? So a feeling just kind of exists. It has its true nature, which somehow really exists. And we're sort of coming back to that idea of existence that the Buddha was talking about here. You can see how we're kind of getting around to that. But it's not that the self exists. It's that the dhammas exist. Right? And the word swabhava, swab means own, one's own. So you can see there's like a flavor of the self coming in here. Now, this definition of the dhammas was shared among a number of the schools. I'm not exactly sure how many, but certainly Sarvastivadins had a similar idea, and the Theravadins had also a similar idea. So that quote I just mentioned is also, you can find in the Theravadin commentaries. So it was perhaps not universal, but at least was fairly widespread among the Abhidhamma movements. And that was the idea that the Prajnaparamita was criticizing. If you open the Heart Sutra, like the beginning of the Heart Sutra, it begins with the Bodhisattva seeing that, looking at the emptiness of the sabhava, sabhava sunyata, in regards to the five aggregates. So it uses that word sabhava right in the opening of the Heart Sutra. And this also is the main theme of Nagarjuna. It's what he's responding to or reacting to. So if we were to sum up Nagarjuna's thesis, we would say that Nagarjuna's alleging or arguing that the Abhidhamma schools made the same mistake when it comes to dhammas that the Vedic schools made when it comes to the self. Right? Okay, so this is a summary of what Nagarjuna was saying. The Vedists looked at all of this, changing, everything like that, and said there's an abiding, independent essence. And the Abhidhamma said, yes, that's right, there's no abiding independent self, but each of the dhammas that makes us up is abiding and independent. Nagarjuna argued that this is completely incompatible with the idea of dependent origination, because if something exists in and of itself, how can it be caused by something else, right? So this is the basic idea of Nagarjuna as I understand it, all right? So let's make a start. So Nagarjuna has a particular style about him. He's very individual, like he's got a lot of character. And he was either like this really enlightened sage, or perhaps he was like really annoying in person. But I think he was like probably like really fun to be with, because he's not an encyclopedist. Like if you look in, say, the Theravada tradition, someone like Buddhaghosa was an encyclopedist. He wanted to get everything, arrange it, organize it, and put it there so you can refer to everything in one place. Something like Asanga was similar in the Mahayana movement. But Nagarjuna is not like that. Nagarjuna, he wants to play with you. He wants to toy with you. He wants to throw out an idea that's going to make you go, hang on, that can't be right, is it? And then for you to think, well, so this is the kind of thing that he does. And so, of course, because he's so influential, there are countless commentators, whole traditions of Nagarjuna commentary and so on, which I'm not going to get into. One of the things that happened over time was that countless works were attributed to Nagarjuna. In the modern era, scholars first noticed that there are works in Tibetan and Chinese translation attributed to Nagarjuna which were quite different. And so they began to question, actually, all of these by Nagarjuna or not. And scholars have debated this. And the general consensus in modern scholarship is that there are far fewer texts actually written by Nagarjuna than one would imagine. When we say Nagarjuna, who do we mean? We mean the author of the Mula Madhyamika Karika, which is what we're going to look at in a minute. This is a central thesis. So when we say, who is Nagarjuna? We are arguing we are asking who wrote, who did that author of that also write these other treatises or other books? And so there are one of the key details about that is that even though Nagarjuna was universally regarded as a Mahayanist and probably was a Mahayanist, but in his Mula Madhyamaka Karika rarely refers, it doesn't refer explicitly to any Chinese text, sorry, to any Mahayana texts. He alludes to a few perhaps, but most of what he's doing is grounded very much on the early Buddhist teachings. And he refers directly to the Kacchayana Gotta Sutta. And we'll have a look at another few examples of this. So there's kind of an active debate in modern times about what actually his philosophical position was. And personally, I tend to think that his main position was to try to establish a common ground, like a central ground for Buddhist philosophy that wasn't going to be aligned with any particular school. Yeah, so this is what I think that he was actually doing. So he wasn't doing a defense of any particular sectarian interpretation. He was trying to point back to what was the Buddha actually talking about. So somebody's asked for the spelling of the book. There you go. And I'm going to be reading now from, I've got the Sanskrit text here. And I've got a recent translation by, who was the translation Richard Jones. I haven't studied it in detail, but I had a look at it before. It seems like a good translation. So let us begin. Okay, so from the first, the Nagarjuna opens with an opening paragraph. I should mention also that Nagarjuna's text exists in Chinese translation, in Tibetan translation, and in Sanskrit. So it's one of the not all of the Mahayana sutras or texts actually exist in Sanskrit. Only a small proportion of them do. But luckily, we found, I believe, a copy in Nepal or something. Was found in some library, probably like put on the shelf in like the 11th century, and then probably taken off by Rahul Sankrityayana. I'd have to double check that, but he was the one who found a lot of these in Nepal and Tibet. Anyway, okay. I bow to the fully enlightened Buddha, the best of teachers, who taught that whatever arises dependently is unceasing, unborn, unannihilated, impermanent, not coming, not going, and who also taught the peaceful stilling of all conceptual creations. Okay. So Nagarjuna then has a series of chapters dealing with different topics. And I'm not obviously going to try to read the whole thing, but I'm just going to look at a couple of instances. And we're going to begin with the very first opening paragraph. Number one, Nagarjuna, by the way, you know that whole thing that I've just done now where I've tried to ease you into it and bring you all. No, it's Nagarjuna, forget about it. Okay. So Nagarjuna, no entities whatsoever are found anywhere that have arisen from themselves, from another, from both themselves and another, or from no cause at all. Full stop. Okay, got that? Next one. Right? So let's just stay with that one just for a minute, okay? So for those of you who have been with us for the last few weeks, hopefully this is kind of ringing a bell, because notice how he says they have arisen from themselves, from another, from both themselves and another, or from no cause at all. This actually is a teaching that we covered about 3 weeks ago, right? Are things made by oneself? Are they made by another? Are they made by both? Or are they anomalously arisen? Aditya Samuppanna, yeah? That's right, yes, thank you, yes. So it's interesting, right? So Nagarjuna's opening sentence, right? I should mention something else. This is all poetry. Nagarjuna's treatises were written in verse style, which means that to write philosophical texts in poetry is not easy, right? And so this is a prose translation of it, but it does mean that he you know, he will like he's constantly rephrasing things. Like he doesn't express things in terms of the stock phrases that you might come to expect. So you have to sort of be a bit careful to make sure you know what you're saying. But I think this is also part of his style. You know, he wanted to put the, in a way, it does kind of remind me a bit of those Vedic verses like the Nasadiya Sukta and things that we looked at, where you'll just say this something and then you're like, what? And it doesn't feel the need to explain itself all the time. So, of course, there would have been commentaries and teachings and things on it as well, but the text itself is quite bare. So let me repeat, no entities whatsoever are found anywhere that have arisen from themselves, from another, from both themselves and another, or from no cause at all. So again, Nagarjuna here is really just paraphrasing a teaching from the suttas, which he would have assumed that his audience was familiar with. Right, he's just coming along and just saying this. Okay, we're all on the same page here. We know that this is true, and we looked before and we saw that these are associated with the ideas of eternalism, annihilationism. That things arrive from yourself, or things that exist in and of themselves, are things that tend to exist eternally, whereas things that arise from another are things that will perish. So Nagarjuna is kind of setting up his main argument here right from the beginning, right? The very first thing that he says is nasvato, right? Not from oneself, right? Remember I mentioned that his argument was against the thing we call swabhava, the own existence, right? Right, his first word is literally nasvato, not from one's own. Yeah. Again, it's always very kind of clever in the way he puts things. Next paragraph, Sandhika asks, does each teaching stand on its own or makes no sense unless the whole course has been followed? Oh, you're asking about the teachings on dependent origination that we're giving, in which case I'll have to leave your opinion. But no, they do build on each other. If you're talking about Nagarjuna, then definitely he builds on his argument. Yeah, we're not going to be following the whole thing, but he's definitely building it piece by piece. Okay, second verse. There are four conditions for pachaya. The effective cause, this is the translation here, I'm not necessarily convinced of it, but the effective cause, the objective cause, cause of immediacy and cause of domination. Actually, I'm using my own translations here rather than the ones offered. There is no fifth condition. Okay, so we have four conditions. The effective cause is the hetu pachaya, the objective support, the arambana pachaya, the continuity, anantarika pachaya, and the overall domination is adhipati pachaya. These four conditions, these are an abhidhamma category. These are not found in the suttas at all. They're purely an abhidhamma category. In the Theravada, we have 24, okay? Not just four, we have 24, which include these four. So probably these four are one of the earlier expressions of the idea of causality. So like I said before, the Abhidhamma wanted to systematize everything. The Buddha talked about conditionality in all kinds of different ways. The Abhidhamma says, well, we can sum these up as these four, and then Theravada wanted to elaborate and give more detail on that. But the four are kind of the basic ones. So the hetu pachaya is just the effective cause, the thing that makes something come into be. The arambana pachaya is the thing that supports it. So typically the arambanas are the sense objects, okay? So in that case, you can think of the hetu pachaya as being like karma from a past life that has brought you into being, right? That's why you have an eye, because of the karma from a past life. But why you see is because of the arambana, right? Because of the objective support. Yeah? Continuity, anantarika. So this is the idea that there is a flow of conditions, yeah? And the adhipati is the literally means to dominate or to rule. And what it's pointing to here is the idea that there are certain causes that are primary. For example, when you plant a mango seed, the fact that it's a mango seed is like the primary cause. The soil, the water, the sunshine, then they will affect how the mango tree grows. but the fact that it's a mango sea means you get a mango tree and not an orange tree, right? So this is the Adipati Paccaya, something like that, okay? So this is something like what these causes are saying. Now, Nagarjuna is quoting from this Abhidhamma idea, again, assuming people will be familiar with it, and says there's only four, there's no fifth, okay? So in a sense, he's, again, establishing his common ground. He's then, of course, going to go along and criticize all of these four and say they don't mean anything like what you thought that they meant, okay? But he's setting up his ground on the suttas and on the Abhidhamma, right? In a sense, he's showing off his knowledge. He wants you to know that he knows these things. Okay. Then he goes on. The next one, clause number three. The self-existence of entities is not found in their conditions. And if there is no self-existence, no other existence can be found either. Okay. Nahi swabhava. So here we have the first occurrence of the word swabhava, which I mentioned before, inherent existence. Nahi swabhava bhavanang pratyayadi su vijate. So no existence of the swabhava can be found in the conditions. And if the inherent existence or own existence cannot be found, then the other existence is also not found. So you can see Nagarjuna is connecting the self and other, right, with the first line, which has come from the suttas, and now he's using that idea of originating from itself and originating from another to critique the Abhidhamma idea of the swabhava. Yeah. So, like I said, quite subtle, quite tricky. And one of the things about Nagarjuna is that I can give you the, sorry, someone's asked for the thing. There's the, no, sorry, that's just my local file. You can just delete that. Sorry, I thought I was looking at that on the internet. No, that's just my local file. I don't have those to share exactly with you right now, Venerable. Sorry about that. Anyway, let's continue. Okay. So one of the things is when you see what Nagarjuna is saying in the Sanskrit, that you can recognize he's constantly alluding to things in the suttas. And he's building up his argument by just referring to things assuming that his audience is already very well educated and is able to follow along. Okay, so then he goes on to another argument. Activity does not have conditions, nor does it not have conditions. Moreover, conditions do not exist with the power to act, nor without the power to act. So his point here that conditions themselves don't have the power to act. Conditions are called conditions, pracheya, because something arises dependent on something else. But as long as that something does not arise, why are the conditions not really non-conditions? Okay, so this is one of those things that he's just kind of messing with you a bit here, right? You have a seed. The mango seed is a condition for the mango tree. But if you haven't planted the seed, how is it a condition? It's just sitting there. It's not conditioning anything. The point, he's making the argument that a mango seed is not a condition for a mango's tree, right? Remember the idea, it does it in and of itself. It's just a lump of matter. It only actually works as a seed in that context, the soil, the water, the sunlight. Then you can say, oh, yeah, it's a condition. But in and of itself, so bhava, how can you even call it a condition? Yeah, a condition is not admitted for either that what is not real or for what is real. If something is non-existent, how could it have a condition? And if something is already existing, how could it have a condition? Again, think about this, right? We say things are conditioned, but if it exists, how could it be conditioned? It just is, and if it doesn't exist, anyway. And so too, when no existing, non-existing, or existing and non-existing basic phenomena, dhammas, are produced, how is any cause admitted? Right? So he started you off. Remember that we've only got a few lines in, okay? And we started out, he was quoting the first line, basically paraphrasing something from the suttas, right? Remember, imagine him talking to his audience in like Nalanda University or something like that. He's quoting from this first line. Everyone's like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I've got that. And then he's referring to this Abhidhamma thing, and everyone's like, oh, yeah, yeah, I've got that. And then like 5 minutes later, everyone's like, what? And you're like, you're beginning to second guess everything that you thought you knew. Yeah.
When you used the word cause,
yes.
Remember a few weeks ago you said like in early Buddhist texts there is no causality.
Right.
Is he doing that?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So the idea is that there's no thing that we can say is a cause. We can observe that process, and we can describe it as being causality, right? But there's no existing thing that is acting as a cause, right? Yeah, causes, yeah. Okay. Yes, Jenny.
In the first part, Nagarjuna was saying about four things, and then he said there is no fifth.
Are there conditions, right? Four conditions, there's no fifth.
I don't know. Why did he say that? What is he referring to? Why?
Because why did he mention that there was no fifth? Because the schools of Buddhism argued with each other about how many conditions there were. And so he's like adopting the view of one particular school here, which I think is probably the Sarvastivadin school. Like the main school that the Mahayana was in dialogue with was the Sarvastivadins. And like some of their ideas are similar to Theravadin Abhidhamma and some of them not. Right, this particular idea of the four conditions is different in Theravada, but Sabhava is similar. So some are similar, some are not. But probably that's what he was doing there. He wanted to. Again, you think about it in terms of like rhetoric and persuasion, right? He's saying, okay, this is where we are. We're all on the same page here. Four conditions, no fifth. Great. Now go on to the next one. Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Okay. All right, I'm going to, so please, for those folks online, please do pop your questions in there and I will get to them if I can. So Sumana asks, dependent origination in past, present and future versus everything is happening at once, which one would make more sense, Bhante or both, as Dhamma is akalika? Sumana, that is exactly the question that I am just about to talk about next week, so you'll have to come back for that one. All right. And Amina asks, is there no such thing as necessary and sufficient cause? All right, so Western concepts of necessary and sufficient cause are like normally in Buddhism, normally causes are held to be necessary, but we don't typically like typically the idea of sufficient cause is a like we believe that there's a whole network of causes which are ultimately very ramified, so it's hard to define what is a sufficient cause. Again, to take that simple example, if I plant a mango seed, okay, so we have certain necessary conditions. We have a mango seed, we have some soil, we have some water, we have air, we have some sunlight. But then how do we define the sufficient causes? For example, what about the absence of pests? Is that a cause? And if you're going to have to define it in terms of the absence of things, you're going to have quite a long list, right? What about temperature? Another one. And so what about, say, soil, you know, microbiology, right? All of these things that we don't really know. So the idea that we can create a sufficient list of conditions is not really, I wouldn't say that it's absent from Buddhism, but it's certainly not characteristic of Buddhist causality. We talk about the main condition and the necessary conditions. Did the West misinterpret the idea of karma then? Yes, but so did everyone else, so that's okay. Is language itself an obstacle to clearly understand it, conveying and understanding the teaching? No, language itself is fine, but it has its limits, that's all. So don't expect it to do everything for you, but it can be mistaken. Oh, my goodness, someone is going to be away for 10 days silent retreat and then won't be able to listen to the talk next week. That is tragic. I will try to do like a really bad talk next week so that you're not missing out on anything, okay, if I remember. But anyway, have a fantastic retreat. And, yeah, please look forward to seeing you when you get back. All right, I'm going to skip ahead in Nagarjuna a little bit. We're going to pop past the aggregates. So he has chapters discussing things like motion and time, action and the one who acts, the limits of the past and the future, what is conditioned and unconditioned, and so on and so forth. And then he discusses each of those in similarly either enlightening or annoying ways, depending on your perspective. I'm going to skip down to the passage on dependent origination because we've just been discussing that, so that's going to be on topic. Are there videos of the previous talks? Yes, there are, thanks to Michael, who's been recording things and putting them online. Michael, do you want to just pop the link for... Oh, there we go. Venerable Prasanna has just done it. So lakanta.live has the recordings of the previous talk. Okay, so we're now down to chapter 26, the 12 steps of the cycle of rebirth, and I'll just read through this passage according to the Jones translation. Shrouded in root ignorance, a person forms the dispositions or sankharas through thought, word, and deed. By the actions based on these dispositions, one goes on to a new state for repeated rebirths. With the dispositions as a condition, consciousness enters a new state of rebirth. With consciousness having entered the new state, name and form arises infused with that consciousness. With the body infused, the domains of the six senses, the five senses and the mind arise. The six domains having appeared, contact comes into being. Thus, consciousness develops dependent on sensing and form together, coming together and the body. Contact is the conjunction of three things, sensing, form, and consciousness. I think he's using, what's he using for sensing? Sorry, just checking the terminology here, 26. Sensing, form, probably passa, right? 3, Tishimana, Badana, Panchaskanda. Sparsha, yes. He's using, normally we would say, no, Sparsha is going to do the three things. Anyway, sorry, just trying to check that terminology. Never mind. Well, let's move on. Contact is a conjunction of three things. From such contact, sensation arises. Craving has sensation as a condition, that is Vedana or feeling. Since the object of sensation is craved for, when there is craving, clinging to the four domains of clinging arises. Or grasping. When grasping exists, the rebirth of the one who grasps develops. For if one were without clinging, one would be released and there would be no more rebirth. The five bodily aggregates, the five khandhas, are the new becoming, the new existence. From this existence, birth develops, aging, death, suffering, and so forth develop from birth, as do grief, lamentations, dejection, and despair, such as the arising of the complete aggregate of suffering. Thus, the one who is subject to root ignorance forms the dispositions that are the basis of the cycle of rebirths. Thus, the one who is ignorant is the one who forms a new rebirth, not the one who knows by seeing reality. With root ignorance ceasing, dispositions or choices do not come together. However, the cessation of root ignorance comes through meditative development and through knowledge. Important point. Through the cessation of each step, the following step does not arise, thereby the entire aggregate of suffering is completely ended. So this is Nagarjuna's summary of dependent origination. And I think that most of us who have been here for the last few weeks, gradually, hopefully getting our heads around this idea, will probably recognize it's pretty straight, right? He's not really doing anything weird with that at all. He's just, this is giving a description of what dependent origination is in a terms that would be acceptable to pretty much anyone in any school of Buddhism. And he's really just taking those teachings that we've found familiar from the suttas and then sort of rephrasing it in a slightly more of a natural language explanation. It's a nice summary of it, actually. And you can see it's not... He's like, that's one of the things I like about Nagarjuna. He's not a dogmatist. He's not trying to argue, like he's trying to persuade people of his point of view, but he's not like trying to push an ideology. He's trying to open up. Sorry, it looked like we dropped out for a minute there. So yeah, he was trying to shake people out of their different kind of views and so on. But remember, this is now chapter 26. We're now quite close to the end, okay? Nagarjuna has spent most of his time trying to make you feel very uncomfortable, right? To make you come into that lecture hall feeling like you know what you're doing and leaving the lecture hall feeling like, what? Right? And now, as it coming to the end, he's now reestablishing that teaching of dependent origination. And he would always argue that his purpose is not to annihilate or get rid of the Buddha's teaching, but to reestablish the Buddha's teaching free of the unnecessary dogmas. So that's the teaching on dependent origination. And I'm just going to talk about one more passage before we wrap up, and that's this passage on Nibbana, because this is perhaps one of the most controversial and one of the most interesting ones that he said. Let me just see if I can find it. Let me see. Okay, so here's one of the things that he says about Nibbana. Free of acquiring a new rebirth, I shall attain Nirvana. Nibbana shall be mine. For those who cling like this, there is a great clinging and acquisition when there is neither the transfer to Nirvana or the elimination of transmigration, the samsara. What entity Nirvana and what entity transmigration is there being fabricated? Right? So I'm not sure if we'll come across this saying, but one of his saying is that he said that the somebody who's attached to emptiness itself is incurable. Okay. Okay, so it's a section on Nirvana. Okay, so this is this is one of his more controversial statements. There is not the slightest difference between transmigration, between samsara and Nirvana. There is not the slightest difference between Nirvana and samsara. The full extent of Nirvana is the full extent of samsara. There is not the slightest interval between them. Okay, so again, you know, you can see why I like him, right? He's coming in, he's putting out these things. It's like, come on, this is ridiculous. It's like completely the opposite of every Buddhist teaching, right? There's the Nirvana and samsara. It's like there's no completely distinction. And then he's saying that there's not the slightest. But is he saying that they're the same? Like a lot of people will say, oh, Nagarjuna said Nirvana and samsara are the same. But that's not quite what he's saying, though, is it? He's very subtle, yeah? Yeah. And remember the previous sentence, it says, it should not be inferred that the Blessed One exists after death, nor that he does not exist, nor both, nor neither. It is not to be inferred that even a currently living Blessed One exists, or that he does not exist, nor both, nor either. Right? There is not the slightest distinction. So the word that he's using here is vishesha. Na saṃsārasya nirvānat kiñcit asti viśeṣaṇa. Asti, there is, there exists. There is not an existing distinction, even the slightest one, between nirvana and saṃsāra. Uh-huh. Right? And so what he's pointing to is not asserting that they are the same. He's saying that if you try to find the one thing that's going to differentiate them, you're inevitably going to fail, because your search for that is going to be subjective and driven by attachments. The point about understanding Nirvana is to be free, and it's not to be able to define this has this inherent existence and this has this one, and we're going to define all the characteristics of this and define all the characteristics of this. And so his point, I believe that this is the point that he's arguing, that he's trying to point out, that like, don't get too hung up on thinking that you can capture the nature of samsara and nirvana by using your words and your definitions. The full extent of samsara, so he's translated the full extent, but this is in Sanskrit is nirvana. Oh, this is also an interesting one. Nirvanasya cha ya koti samsara nasya cha. So again, like the Buddha would always be trying to say that nirvana and samsara are very different. But here he says that the koti, and this is a technical word, which you really have to know the suttas before you can make sense of, okay? The koti is a reference here to the pubbakoti, or the first point of samsara. This is a famous sutta reference, which Nagarjuna was obviously familiar with and his audience would have been familiar with, right? So the Buddha was saying that, remember we talked about this, that there's no first point in the beginning, it's unknown first origin of everything. But what he's saying is that if there were a first origin of rebirth, it would also be the first origin of nirvana. Think about it, right? You can't get enlightened unless you're suffering. So if there was no existence before that point, there couldn't have been a nirvana. So if there was a first point, that means nirvana must have been created when that first point was created. Right? Right? There's no beginning, right? Or at least unknown beginning, right? Unknown beginning, right? But so Nagarjuna, again, he's being kind of naughty here, right? He's trying to say, oh, it's just, and you're like, but actually it's kind of an interesting point, right? That there's only the realization of nirvana because we are trapped in suffering. And if there were no beings trapped in suffering, there wouldn't be a realization of nirvana. Yeah. So this is some of the... if all basic phenomena, if all dhammas are empty, what is without a limit and what has a limit? What has both no limit and a limit? What has neither? Indeed, what is the same or different? What is eternal and what is not? What is both eternal and not? What is neither? The stilling of all conceptual support. This is stilling of all... Hang on, 21, conceptual support, verse 24. Stilling of all, okay. Oh, right, yeah, okay. So sarvo palambanas o pashama, pancho pashama shiva. So the stilling of all, I wouldn't say conceptual support, so Nagarjuna is again using a special technical word here derived from the suttas. And this is used in the sense in the discussion of a self. And it's used in the sense that if you don't, if the idea of a self is not actually acknowledged or acknowledged as fact, so the idea is that with the stilling of all of those things that are acknowledged as fact, I'm not sure if I'm conveying this correctly, but he's again quoting from the suttas or referring to the suttas. The second one, the stilling of the projection of concepts onto reality is peace. So here the word is prapancha, prapanchu pasama shiva. Again, this is a quote from the suttas, the proliferation, right? So the stilling of proliferation is peace, is shivang. And this word shivang is, of course, the word Shiva, as in the god Shiva, but here in Buddhism it's used occasionally as an adjective in its original meaning, which is the peace or the state of peace. And the Buddha used that particular phrase, prapancho pasaman shivang, as a description of nibbana, and Nagarjuna is here quoting from it. So that's Nagarjuna on nibbana, and then let me just finish up with his last words here. In addition, because all entities are empty, what views of permanence and so on can arise in whom, about what, and how? I bow to Gautama the Buddha, who through compassion taught the true doctrine for removing all views. Sadharma, the true teaching for removing all views. So one of the controversies around Nagarjuna is the extent to which he was he was establishing his own view, or did he just want to tell everybody else that they were wrong? Right? And clearly there's a large part of that, right? Clearly a large part of what he's doing is kind of sweeping away misconceptions, or what he saw as being misconceptions. That's clearly the case. But was that all that he was doing? Did he have a distinctive teaching of his own that he was establishing? I think he would probably say no. He would probably say he's just trying to highlight what was the Buddha's original teaching. And so he's sweeping things away. So there's basically, after he died, after his time, there were two schools of interpretation among Nagarjunian scholars. So that the school that arose after him is called Madhyamaka school, and he is kind of the leading philosopher in that school, and that's the main philosophical school in Tibetan Buddhism. Right, so the Galug school and so on, these all regard themselves as being Madhyamaka. So Madhyamaka is a philosophical interpretation of the Mahayana teachings. And in the Madhyamaka, there are two main branches, one of which says that Nagarjuna and Madhyamaka establishes its own doctrine, and the other one which says, no, we're just here to laugh at everybody else's and to get rid of all views. So again, that's one of the subtleties in understanding Nagarjuna. So let me just pop back into the chat and see if there are any other questions here. Now, was Nagarjuna predicted by the Buddha? No, he didn't. He didn't go around predicting things like that. Like he would talk about tendencies and project tendencies, but depending on how people behaved. Yeah. June says, thanks for another excellent talk. Well, June, thank you. I'm glad that I made some kind of sense. Tessa says, he is punk rock. Thanks, Tessa, for that contribution. Couldn't agree more. Chapter 25 for Nibbana. Is Nagarjuna saying no view can be correct? Yes, exactly. So from Gillian. So yes, exactly. This is what the question is. Is he saying that views themselves need to be got rid of, or do we just get rid of the wrong view? And there are these different ways of looking at Nagarjuna from that point of view. Tamara mentions it was many talks ago that you mentioned Henry Olcott and theosophy and their relationship with Buddhism. Can you elaborate on that? Is Olcott still remembered with respect in Sri Lanka? Yeah. As far as I can tell, it's a moment, right, when the European powers stopped being just give us all your money and gems and stuff, and started to be actually there might be something worthwhile here, and so that was kind of a real kind of shift. But yeah, certainly the theosophist had a lot of wacky ideas. It would be kind of interesting. Like, I've not really read that, but it would be really interesting to know, like, what, like, the Sri Lankan monks at the time thought of them, you know? Because Henry Olcott was more kind of straight down the line, but certainly Madame Blavatsky was pretty out there. Anyway, Letty says, oh, wonderful talk. Oh, Letty, I'm glad that that could be good. I was not really sure because, like I said, I don't really know that much. And it just personally, I think Nagarjuna would have been someone who was really fun to have a chat with, you know? And I think, like, his work can be intimidating. It is intimidating. And a lot of the time I just stare at it and I go, what? But that's actually good. Like, to be placed in that place of not knowing is actually, that's how you grow. That's why it's stimulating. So it just encourage people to have a look. Don't be intimidated. And there's quite a few different books about him and so on. Okay, Christelle says, thanks, Bhante. Interesting. Oh, thank you, Christelle. Dhamma Kippa, Venerable. It was fun. Excellent. I'm glad I could make Nagarjuna fun. Excellent. And Amina says, question, Nagarjuna was within the two truths school. I think so, yeah. Could you speak about the three truths school another time? Amina, I don't know enough details about those things to talk about that, but I will say that as far as the two truths, ultimate truth and conventional truth, there is some controversy again about what exactly, how Nagarjuna is positioned within that idea. And so, yeah, but I won't go into that now. And okay, so some more thanks from everybody there. So thank you, everybody, for coming with me on this journey. Jenny.
So did Nandajana suggest that Nibbana was subjective?
Did Nagarjuna suggest that Nibbana was subjective? What do you mean by subjective?
Like, it's not. It really depends on each person.
Oh, it depends on each person, right?
But Nibbana is, you know, the version of someone's Nibbana is.
Right.
The same as
right.
Someone else.
So I mean, Nagarjuna was certainly opposed to the idea of like that we could like objectively define things and sort of settle once and for all what it's going to be. I mean, if you think about like Nibbana, if you think about the experience of an enlightened person, okay, and you say, well, how does an enlightened, if they experience Nibbana, how do they experience it? Well, everyone's different. Because they're different people and they have different experiences. But what they will share is they have no greed, hate, and delusion. Right? So there's something which they have in common. Yeah. Thanks everybody for coming along. Thanks for sticking with me through all of these things. Next week I'm going to look at next week's going to be fun. I'm going to look at all of the wrong views about dependent origination. Yes, I don't know if you've got any ideas for that. I've got some of the greats who I'm going to be debunking next week, respectfully. anyway, that should be fun. And then we will finish up with some suttas about the practical application and implications of dependent origination. All right, so Venerable Prasanna is mentioning that there is a sutta discussion at Rhonda Place in Concord this coming Sunday, 1:30 p.m. What sutta are you discussing this week, Venerable? Maharahulavada Sutta, excellent. So for those of you who have the good karma to be living in Sydney, and especially to be living in the Inner West or thereabouts, then go along on Sunday. Oh, and we're doing Pindabhata, right? Yeah, so we'll be doing Pindabhata on Sunday. So if you're in Burwood around there, come along and we'll be around 11 o'clock and we'll be having lunch in the park, which will be fun. So we do that once a month. That's on this Sunday. Okay, everybody, thank you so much for your attention. Thank you for keeping on practicing the Dhamma and giving hope to those of us who are surrounded by the world and all of the things that's happening in the world, and to know that within this world there are still beautiful people who are intent on doing something really lovely and really pure. So that's really inspiring for me. Thanks, everybody, and see you again soon.